With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hello, and welcome to Strange Dominions. I am your host, Octavian Graves, and I am here with the vengeful spirit himself, Alden Bartley.
Hails, brother. Good evening.
Good evening, and hails to you, too. Tonight, we have a very exciting episode for you. We are speaking with Luke Bell, ceremonial magician of over 10 years. He is also writing a book on his experiences in ceremonial magic, and this is such a wealth of information on the topic, as well as magic in general. I think that our listeners are really going to learn a lot from what he's experienced and what he has learned about the cosmos and the whole system of ceremonial magic. What was your favorite part, Alden?
Well, he certainly has a way with words.
He is an absolute wordsmith, you're right.
Master of analogies, as you're about to discover. My favorite thing about speaking with Luke, beyond my own fascination with the topics that he's discussing, is the authority with which he speaks about them. He doesn't come across as overbearing, but this is a man who knows what he knows, and he'll tell you when he does not know. And he's not making you take a lot on faith.
No, and he commands respect, but he also allows you to know that he doesn't know everything and that he's still learning just like we are. So I'm really, really excited for you guys to hear. We do have our Patreon up. There are four tiers. The first tier is a small $4 a month, and with that you get extra content. With tier two, you get extra content as well as a sticker and the chance to be on the show as a guest and to be part of our AMA series. Tier three, you get unlocked content, a sticker, as well as a pin, and the opportunity to be a guest on the show and be a part of the AMA series. And tier four has all of that plus a patch. So if you want to support the show and you want to get extra content, there will be a link to our Patreon in the show notes, as well as a link to all of Luke's information. If you have seen something strange or unusual and you would like to be on the show, please send us an email at strangedominionspodcast@gmail.com. That is strangedominionspodcast@gmail.com. And with that, let's get into the interview. Tonight we have an absolute pleasure of a show tonight. We are going to be speaking with Luke Archman, who is a ceremonial magician and possible author. So how are you, Luke?
Doing very well. Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here, gentlemen.
It's a pleasure to have you, really.
Thank you very much indeed. Just before we continue, I should probably clarify. My last name is Bell, but that's totally fine. You can refer to me as whatever you prefer.
Okay. Well, we'll just call you Luke for now.
Sounds good.
All right, Luke, so you've been a ceremonial magician for around 10 years or so, is that correct?
Just over that, yeah, just over that. What I consider to be my actual practice, a lot of that prior to that 10-year period was research, which I don't really count, but yeah, practicing ceremonial magic pretty solidly for just over 10 years now.
Awesome. So how did you get into it? Where was your beginning?
Well, I always find this a little bit of a difficult question to answer as to where my interest in magic came from, but I'll do my best to trace back into the depths of time for you. So I grew up in a fairly, as you can probably tell by my accent, I'm not from North America. I grew up in a fairly Christian household in London and the surrounding areas, but loosely Christian in the way that most English families are. You know, you attend church on Christmas and other holidays, but we weren't by any means strictly religious. My mother has always had an interest in the esoteric. A lot of my family lived in and still live in Cairo and Alexandria in Egypt. So I grew up hearing stories of the Nile and the old gods, Anubis and Osiris. I probably knew who Horus was before I knew what a Power Ranger was, you know. So I think all of those things shape your experiences as a child and kind of lay the foundation for you to have interest in these esoteric things afterwards. As I got older, I began having, like a lot of magicians, some rather unusual experiences as a child with things like sleep paralysis and, you know, what people would consider traditionally paranormal phenomena and the experience of those kinds of entities that I still to this day haven't really figured out what they are or what they were and still to this day, you know, have experiences like that. I got to the age of 15, and I started writing music and started playing instruments. And it was around that time that I had a bizarre experience that started to occur. I began to get a reoccurring dream in which I would. Can you still hear me, gentlemen?
Yes, you're loud and clear.
Yes, I'm sorry. I thought you cut you. Cut out for a moment there. I began to have a reoccurring dream where I would see a large wolf-like black dog, and the dream would happen in the same way, and it would be set in like an abandoned building, and there were ruins everywhere, but there was this solitary black dog that looked very threatening, but I felt no threat from him, and I began interacting with this animal in the dreamscape, as it were, and it would whisper melodies and lyrics to songs to me that I would then remember when I woke up and start. I would, you know, recompose them from memory from what I'd heard in my dream. And I'd always wondered what this creature was because it felt like something very external. You know, perhaps it's what the ancient Greeks might have referred to as my daemon, you know, one of my kind of like helpful spirits that knocks around in my subconscious. Anyway, these curious experiences piqued my interest in childhood. And in school, I was always very, very interested in religious history and the beliefs of human beings. My religious studies teacher was from Africa. He was from Zimbabwe, and he was a very strict Baptist Christian, but he did used to tell us about folk magic and sorcery practices in back in Africa. I kind of thought that was a lot more interesting than Christianity or any of the other religions, because it sounded like these guys were onto something. You know, it sounds like if they could do the crazy things that he was claiming that they do, then that's something that's worth for sure looking into. So, you know, alongside those experiences, I also had an avid interest in older literature and was reading the works of H.P. Lovecraft and Edgar Allan Poe, which are all replete with strange stories of weird rituals and witchcraft and odd things. So I was kind of inadvertently immersing myself in what would later become quite a passion for the occult sciences. as I got older into my later teens, I began seeking out actual literature that I could practice, something that I could use. My first kind of experience in actually practicing a ritual was I suppose it sounds quite silly now, but as a, you know, as a 15-year-old lad, this is the kind of thing that you do. I was rather lazily not particularly interested in finishing an essay at school, and I'd come across a fairly obscure book on witchcraft, not Wicca, mind you, but traditional English witchcraft in a secondhand bookshop in not far from where I lived, and thought, well, you know, I really don't want to do this essay, and if my teacher doesn't come into school tomorrow, I probably won't have to hand it in. So I took a gamble and performed what I suppose could be called a spell or a ritual, and went into school the next day, kind of, you know, not 100% sure whether I was going to be in a fair bit of trouble or whether this would have worked. And it turned out that, you know, my teacher didn't come in today that day, and I didn't have to happen the essay, which was great. The issue was that she actually came down with a rather severe case of pneumonia and ended up in hospital for about 3 weeks, which I felt rather guilty about. She was fine, she recovered, but I kind of got my first taste of, you know, the magnitude of things that can occur as a result of doing some of these practices. And so, you know, I thought, well, that's really interesting. And it kind of spurred my interest in it in quite a big way. By the time I left home and was living on my own, I'd absorbed quite a lot of the old grimoires. I don't think even at that stage I really quite understood all of them, but was trying to find a way to actually put them into practice, because at, you know, at some point you have to, you can only read so much, and you really want to start seeing what you can do with this stuff. And I landed myself a part-time job while I was studying in a furniture store that was located in a fairly trendy part of London. And it was in an old building. I think it was about 200 or 300 years old. And so this huge old townhouse converted into a shopfront. They had a rather sizable basement. Because I'd been working there a while, I had keys to the shop, and my apartment was literally a 30-second walk from this place. So I got the bright idea that I should start utilizing that basement space, because I certainly couldn't do what I wanted to do with the roommates that I was living with at the time. And so that's exactly what I did. I would wait till silly hours in the morning, and I would go into this basement, and I would start practicing in the way that it laid out in the grimoires, and seeing what results I got. And it kind of went from there, really. And it's one of those things that never, one of those passions that has never waned. You know, it's never been a phase. It's always been something that I've been very, very invested in.
Well, you brought up a very interesting point, because you brought up Lovecraft. And as someone who has been fascinated with Lovecraft since I was a boy, that was one area that I became exposed to occultism and the esoteric, along with, you know, I found Lovecraft and Crowley at the same time. And so those two names kind of get tied into each other in various ways. I actually have a copy of the Necronomicon here. But that brings us to a point that I'd like to talk about, which is sort of the misconceptions about magic and ceremonial magic. Because I think if someone were to read Lovecraft, who has been a big influence on me, and I would dare to say a large majority of the current occult community, and you get images of... you know, cultists in black robes and candles trying to bring about these massive, incomprehensible creatures for the sole goal of ending existence. And I wonder how, if that has sort of been a detriment to the understanding of magic as a whole. And I just want to know what your perception is on that.
But that's a really good and interesting question. Lovecraft's effect on the occult, I've never really spent too much time thinking about it, but I think Lovecraft, just like any form of media that has attempted to portray the occult, always does so in a fairly inaccurate way. And you know, by virtue of the fact that it's fiction, it's sensationalized to a large degree. I think that the problem with relying on particularly works of cosmic horror like H.P. Lovecraft or gothic horror like Edgar Allan Poe or even any of the slightly more modern things like Dennis Wheatley, I think, has been a route with the author of The Devil Rides Out, To the Devil a Daughter, and various works like that, and you know, has been a pathway into the occult for a lot of people. I think that what it does is paints it in A, as inherently negative light. It's seldom the protagonists of the story that are the practitioners. It's usually some mad wizard, you know, trying to watch the world burn for, you know, vague bad guy reasons. Whether or not that's been helpful or not to the practice of magic in general is something that is a difficult question to answer, really. What I can say is that real ceremonial magic is far from what you see portrayed in the media. It's not something that is profane or dark or spooky. It's a very, very old tradition, you know, and magic in its various incarnations has been a pretty integral part of the human experience for a very, very long time. You know, we're talking thousands of years, and generally these practices have been held in very high regard and with a great deal of respect. It does seem like things are heading back more that way now. But yeah, I think that in that respect, you have to kind of separate the fact from the fiction, enjoy the fiction for what it is. And it is great, and I love it, and I still love reading, you know, the Cthulhu mythos and all of Lovecraft's work, and can enjoy it in that respect. But as far as it actually pertaining to my practice, it doesn't in any way, really.
I think that the effect that Lovecraft has had on the occult goes both ways. I think that it brought in a lot of people that otherwise may have never found the occult, hopefully that when these people did find it, they dug enough into it to realize that the occult and the esoteric, specifically ceremonial magic, is not how Lovecraft really described it. And so I hope in that way that they came to it from somewhat of a disingenuous origin, but then found the genuine parts of it afterwards. From what you've experienced and what you do, how would you explain to someone who has no idea about magic, specifically ceremonial magic, what is ceremonial magic? How would you describe that or explain that to a complete and total layman?
Well, it's difficult to divorce magic from the context in which that particular word is usually seen, because it's one that is in fairly common parlance to describe a multitude of different things. And the idea of something being magical evokes whimsical images in the head of, you know, fairies and pixies and Walt Disney. So I think to the subtext in that is quite hard to pass out for some people. But, you know, Aleister Crowley gave a very good definition of magic in that it's causing change by action at a distance. And that's about as concise as you can get with it. But magic is I think it's fundamentally misunderstood in a lot of ways. A lot of people, I think, believe that it's some kind of unifying universal force, you know, like electricity or gravity. And that you hear people talking about the flow of magic or, you know, blockages in magic and things like that. And that's not really accurate. Magic, at least in my experience, is that magic is the technique. magic is the technology, as I've heard other people put it, which is a really good way of describing it. I think it's the method. The method is magic. What's actually causing the change is what are loosely referred to as the spirit in which you contact by use of magic. And it's the spirits that cause the change. And I think that magic in all of its really genuine forms is all to some way, shape or form spirit-based. And there are people that would disagree with me on that, I know, and that's fine. But I think that the fact is that it's not actually magic that is causing the changes in that you're seeing as your result. It's the spirits that you contact by way of that are actually doing that. So magic is a method by which you can contact entities that exist outside of corporeal reality in order to affect change in the physical world. I think that's about as concise as I could possibly get with it.
So what you're basically describing is more of a science than any kind of spiritual work. Am I understanding you in that?
Yes, I think you are. And, I think people do conflate spirituality with magic in a very way. And it's become, they've become kind of amalgamated, I think, in a lot of people's heads. And there's various reasons for that. And Dr. Stephen Skinner unpacks this much better than I ever could. But they are very different. They're two very, very different things. Magic is not a religion. It doesn't require any kind of faith-based devotion, as far as I can see. It's a method, and it's a practical method. And to describe it as scientifically, which I think a lot of people will find to be a real conflict in terms there, but it is. And a lot of the people that practice magic who are of note in history were scientists. And there was a time when the occult and hard sciences like medicine and physics and chemistry were not mutually exclusive, and they were both areas of exploration into what makes up our physical reality. And somewhere around the Enlightenment period, those two things separated seemingly irreversibly, and we still have this skepticism and superstition surrounding what magic is in the West, largely put forward, ironically enough, by people that never tried or practiced or researched it. But it was always intended to be a science. It was always intended to be a method. And there's a reason that it has existed for as long as it has, because I do believe that there's some objective truth to it, and the methods work. As to the different types of magic, you mentioned the delineation between ceremonial magic. Ceremonial magic is kind of a loose umbrella term that is used to describe magic that we have in the West, our Western tradition of magic, which is mainly concerned with the conjuring and commanding demons or the petitioning of angels. The practice in different parts of the world looks different, but ultimately, what it comes down to is that they are working with and compelling spirits to do things in the physical world that we would otherwise be unable to do, and that includes what people would consider root work and traditional witchcraft and voodoo and things like that. Hoodoo and things like that, which I can go into a little bit later. I have some theories on what that is there.
Well, I tend to agree, and I think that while my initial understanding of magic was that of more of a fantastical view, the more that I've learned about it and the more that I've researched it, I've come to understand that it's a lot more pragmatic and practical than how it generally is perceived, at least in the West, and how most people approach it. So one of the things that you mentioned was, angels and demons, and that is more or less what this is concerning. And I'm sure that there are people who will hear that, people of not magical means and have no understanding of this. Can you go into a little bit about the terminology and where it comes from and what its true meaning is and the difference between its true understanding and true meaning versus how most people would perceive those terms like angels and demons and spirits?
Of course. Yeah, I'd be delighted to. I use angels and demons again as a very loose term. I don't think that they're particularly fitting to the creatures that you are making contact with. And I think, again, unless you're fairly immersed in the occult, you would have ideas that are colored by, you know, our religious background in the West as mainly Judeo-Christian, as well as things that are shown to you in the media that would.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+ terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
That would affect what your perception of those things are. I should preface this by saying that, you know, I'm in no way suggesting that I have some kind of fundamental understanding of the nature of these beings. I'm still just like anybody else learning what they are. I can only talk from my interactions and experiences that I've had with them over the course of my practice. So I tend to use the term spirits to kind of cover any of the entities that you contact by way of ceremonial magic. But they do seem to be segregated into particular species, I guess is one way of saying it, although it's not the perfect way, but I think that's the best I can do with that one. Different species of creature, and they behave differently. Demons, or at least in this respect, when we're talking about demons, we're usually referring to chthonic spirits that are conjured and compelled using magic. And I think the most common that people are aware of is the spirits that are listed in the catalogue in the Lemegatons Goetia, which is probably one of the most famous and most used grimoires today. And there's 72 spirits that are listed in there, and they're generally categorized as demons, partly because of their nature and the things that they can do, and partly because of the Christian paradigm in which these grimoires were written. And angels, I find them a lot harder to define. I think that there's a duality that people approach the angelic and the demonic issue with, in which they assume, well, you know, angels are all completely good and full of light and love and just want to give you a big hug and everything to turn out well for you. And demons are these inherently bad creatures that will, you know, just ruin your life, and all they're interested in doing is making you do hideous and profane things and possessing you and making your head spin around and making you vomit green stuff all over a priest. And, you know, that's just not my experience with them at all. I think that if I was to try and define what an angel is, I think that they're less the winged beings that are flying around holding harps in long flowy robes, and more that they are rather grand and immense governors of certain aspects of reality. And they're obviously very popular in the New Age movement as well, but I don't think that they quite understand the nature of them. And I'm not saying that I do by any stretch of the imagination, but they are immensely powerful spiritual creatures that I think could do you a lot of damage if they wanted to as well. They should be approached with the same kind of respect and not with the kind of cavalier attitude that I think some people do approach them with as a result of some of the stuff that's in the public zeitgeist at the moment. I know that wasn't a massively concise explanation of what either of those two beings are, but as I say, I'm still trying to figure that one out myself to a large degree.
I think that was a perfect introductory answer, and I'm sure that we'll get more into that topic later on. One thing that I'm curious about is your take on the theory that when we look at the 72 demons in the Goetia, yeah. I've heard many people talk about how that at one time they were most likely gods of the Mesopotamian era, and that they were in no way demonic, but when Christianity came about and began converting as many people as they could, their method was basically saying that the gods that these people worshipped, that they were actually demons, and that the only way to purge them of their lives was to worship the one true God. And so I'm curious to know what your take on, if you've heard that theory, and what your perception of that theory is.
I have heard that theory, and I think everybody that spent even a modicum of time within the occult community has heard that theory. And to some degree, it's not without merit. I can see why people would certainly think that. The example that's usually cited is the demon Astaroth, which is the people who push the theory forward believe can be traced back to the Phoenician goddess Astarte. And I can certainly see why that is. As far as the other 72 spirits, their origins are very murky. Their origins are very, very murky. Perhaps you're right. Perhaps at some point or another, these beings were worshipped by gods in other civilizations. I know some of the more famous creatures that are mentioned, beings like Moloch and Mammon. You know, these beings certainly were worshipped as gods at one point or another. But as far as the Goetia spirits, I think the jury is very much still out on that. I don't think that that's a solid explanation as to where they're from. Because you can see interactions with spirits that seem to follow the same patterns of behavior in very ancient texts. And magicians that have come across these particular beings that have a certain behavior set, and they're not classified as gods, you know. And these were people that were from cultures that were largely polytheistic. So they had their idea of what gods were, and they had their idea of what lesser spirits were. And I think demons usually fell into the category of lesser spirits. So I lean away from that as an explanation as to what they were. Very possible that some of them were. Unfortunately, the Catholic Church did a rather effective job of attempting to eradicate any practice of magic from the face of the planet. So we have huge, huge gaps in the history and lineage of some of these beings and when people first started interacting with them. So I fear that for some, we'll never know. But as I say, the jury is very much still out. But I would have my doubts on being able to categorize all of them as old gods from the ancient times.
I can totally understand that point of view, and I would tend to agree with you that the jury is still out, and that there's not a lot of historical records regarding the origin of many of these entities, and so a lot of the perceptions about them most likely come through some sort of unverified personal gnosis.
Correct.
So one thing that I've always been curious about is, like, the grimoires that we use, or that people use for this purpose of ceremonial magic. Where, I'm trying to think of a proper way to phrase this question, other than asking, you know, where do they come from? But in your view, How are they able to compile this information? I mean, where did it all start for the authors of these works to compile such a specific and detailed instruction on how to contact these entities, how to handle them, how to bind them, how to go about communicating with them?
Well, that is a really good question, and one that I think much smarter people than I have been attempting to answer for a very, very long time. Because you're right, the directions are very, very specific in the grimoires, and we can get into this a little bit later on, but I don't think that any of those steps are arbitrary, and they all have a purpose. And I think the more you practice and the more you practice to the letter of the book, you start to realize that these things make your practice a lot more effective if you actually follow them. As to when people first realized this, there must be an origin to it somewhere, but I have no idea when that was. Some of the earliest manuscripts that we're aware of that show the practice of what we would now today consider ceremonial magic, the Greek magical papyri, or the PGM manuscripts, which are a set of manuscripts that came from the Hellenistic period of Egypt, and they're essentially the working notes of a Greco-Egyptian magician that show a lot of the same techniques that you see in the modern-day grimoires. And some scholars of history have done a very good job with tracing those manuscripts forward through from Egypt through the ancient world and into Europe. So we kind of have an idea as to how they found their way into the hands of medieval and Renaissance magicians. And as you would expect, before the days of the sharing of mass information, these things had to be copied out by hand, and they were usually copied in secret because you could be skinned alive or burned at the stake for even being in the same room as one of these manuscripts or books. And so there is likely a little bit of dilution of some of the information that came forward, and things change, and they change on the cultural context in which they're written, and things that were originally written from an ancient Egyptian paradigm slowly start to become Christianized when they're copied up by Christian monks. So I think that we don't know where the genesis point for that was. Some people have suggested that there was some kind of divine genesis from it, and you can see in apocryphal texts in the Bible explanations for that in things like the Book of Enoch, where it talks about the fallen angels teaching charms and enchantments to humanity as part of their rebellion whilst they were busy breeding with human women. So, you know, potentially there was something along those lines, but I couldn't tell you exactly where they came from, I'm afraid, and I'm not sure anybody can as of yet. And hopefully someday we make more discoveries and more manuscripts are discovered, and we can start to piece together more of the puzzle. But at the moment, it's a very fragmented history and a very fragmented system.
It is
part of the job.
And I think that things such as archaeology could possibly someday give us some answers as far as the true origin of this specific practice. When it comes to grimoires, which ones would you say, which ones have you worked with, and which ones would you say have been most successful to you, or you've had most success with, and which ones have you seen to be more difficult and more adversarial to work with?
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club.
Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino.
That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Good question. I've worked, I mean, I think like a lot of magicians, I've started off with some of the more famous grimoires. I would say that the one that I've worked most from is the Le Megaton of Goetia. But I've experimented with a number of them, including the Heptameron and the Grand Grimoire and a few others as well. I always end up going back to the Goetia because that's what I spent most time learning and practicing, and the one that I've had most success with, I'd say. And I think that a lot of people make the mistake in thinking, at least when you're just kind of taking your first steps into magic, that the Lesser Key of Solomon is solely concerned with the conjuring and commanding of demons. I mean, the Goetia is, for sure, which is one of the books in the Lesser Key of Solomon, but the Lesser Key is actually comprised of a number of books which is concerned with something, many different types of spirits, demons being one of them, but also angels and other entities as well. But that's a long way of answering your question and just saying that the Goetia is the one that I keep going back to. It's the old favorite.
Well, I think that would be the case for a lot of people. I mean, if you look up grimoires or have ever heard anyone talk about them, they're most likely, as far as I've experienced, referring to the Lesser Key. That's the one that I was most aware of for most of my life when it came to magic and ceremonial magic. I didn't even really understand. I didn't know about Grimoire of Dr. Rudd until probably a few years ago, and the Heptameron as well is very new to me. But I think that the Lesser Key, would you say that you could go your entire life as a ceremonial magician only with the Lesser Key? I mean, is it kind of the one-stop shop for this kind of magic, or would you say that it's more beneficial to look through all the grimoires and try and work from each one or as many as you can find?
Well, I think that's an interesting question, because certainly the Goetia of Dr. Rudd, as you mentioned, which is a version of the Goetia, and the version that most people have encountered, which is the one that's translated by Samuel Liddell McGregor Mathers, with the foreword by Alistair Crowley in it, which, you know, does have some glaring mistakes in there that authors and researchers have corrected later on. People like Joseph Peterson, certainly worth looking up his edition of the Lesser Key of Solomon. Very good. Now, regards to whether it's a one-stop shop, no, I wouldn't say that it is. And I would say that it behooves every fledgling magician to read as many grimoires as is physically possible. The Goetia, just like any other grimoire, is not complete in its system that it outlines. It's fairly complete. It's probably more complete than quite a few of them. But reading a lot of grimoires is essential for when you're just beginning in magic, because you can start to see the commonalities between them. And once you realize what those commonalities are, then you realize what the crucial steps to the ritual are. And that gives you a very firm basis in being able to actually start putting this into practice. Because at some point, you have to slip out of the armchair and into the circle. And in order to do that, you have to kind of know what you're doing.
I love that analogy. I hope to use that analogy myself someday.
By all means. Well, I think from our conversations, it does seem like you are slipping out of the armchair and into the circle in the very near future.
I very much hope so.
I'm sure you will. I'm sure you will. But I wouldn't say that the Goetia is a one-stop shop. And I think that most magicians worth their salt will experiment with a number of different grimoires, because there are different spirits. Some of them do have spirits in common, but there are different entities that you can contact for different purposes throughout the grimoire. So I think the more experienced you become as a magician and the more interested in this subject that you get, the more keen you are to try different systems and see what results you get of them. It's part of the fun of practicing magic is that you have quite a lot to be able to experiment with. And it's fun to compare results with other people and, you know, find out that they've got something similar or even something different, you know, and you kind of keep that dialogue going. So I wouldn't call it a one-stop shop, no, but it certainly is the one that I've used the most. It's certainly the one that I feel most comfortable with.
One thing that I've always been curious about is when you go online and you try, you know, I am an aspiring magician. I'm still very much a novice, both in practice and theory. But when you go online and you try and meet and talk to other quote-unquote magicians, you find a vast array of different and conflicting information. You know, mm-hmm. I've seen things that people have said, you know, oh, I've summoned Lucifer in the bathroom, or I have summoned Belial to help me make a milkshake. When you're starting out, you know, those are exaggerated examples, but I hope that the point gets across. When someone's starting out in this tradition, and I do call it a tradition, who's to know, like, how do you know what is truthful, what is genuine, and what is posturing and inflated and more egocentric in that regard? I mean, where does, you know, if you don't know at all, if you're completely naked in this, where do you find your clothes, if that's an appropriate analogy?
That's a fantastic analogy, yeah. And that is a very real problem. And it's one that I think a lot of fledgling magicians face, because one of the great benefits of the age of information that we live in is that now more than ever there are so many grimoires and publications. There's so much information out there to actually help you along. You know, most people I think who even started practicing in the 60s and 70s could never have dreamed that you could jump online and buy your ritual tools or order consecrated robes from somewhere, you know. And not that I particularly recommend ordering things from other people, but that's a different discussion. But my point is that there are so many resources available now to people who are interested in the occult, and there are more people than ever that are actually practicing magic, and that's a fantastic thing. The downside to that, of course, is that there's a lot of nonsense out there, an awful lot of nonsense, and an awful lot of bad information, particularly in social media. And it is very difficult.
Are you saying that TikTok is not a reliable source for magical information?
would I ever say something like that? Goodness me, the grimoire that is TikTok, the lethargy of TikTok. No, it's not a reliable source of magical information, and it's a tough one. It's a tough one for a lot of people who are just kind of taking their first steps into something that actually can be quite scary for a lot of people. And quite intimidating. How do you figure that out? That's a really good question. Well, I think that the first thing you do is you arm yourself with knowledge before you start entering into serious discourse with other people with regards to what their magical practice is. So at least you have a foundation of it. I would recommend that people pick up a book before they go onto Facebook in search of information on magic. And, you know, that's not to say that there aren't nonsense books out there, because there are. But you're generally safe with the old grimoires. That is the tradition. That is what nigh on all of these practices are based on. So to some degree, I'm a little bit of a purist where that's concerned. And I know that people would disagree with me there. But I think that will provide you with a solid background, at least, so you have some idea as to what's nonsense and what's not. There is you're absolutely right in what you say, and I've personally seen that kind of thing as well on social media, of people saying nonsense stuff, like performing evocations to goetic spirits in the shower. And, you know, it there's this rather alarming trend in the occult community that magic has seemed to be almost an extension of, you know, the heavy metal scene, and people are dressing in black and hanging out in graveyards, and, you know, think it's kind of edgy and cool.
As cool as that is, I totally understand that itself is not magical.
Well, exactly, yes. And you know, far be it from me to question people's fashion choices or musical choices, because that's certainly not what I'm trying to do. But that's not what the practice of magic is at all. And people carving sigils that they believe to be attributed to Lucifer into their arm is not magic either. And you find that quite quickly the people who are posturing and the people that are talking rubbish and they fall away quite quickly, because it loses its novelty. And to actually get results, which you're likely not going to be getting if you're not doing the rituals in a certain way and you're not approaching it in the correct way, it starts to lose its novelty and it starts to become not so fun. And magic is hard work, and it's straining on the body, and it's straining on the mind, and it's straining on the spirit, and it impacts your social life, it impacts your personal relationships. There's a lot of sacrifices that you have to make in order to be able to do these things properly, and it's not inexpensive to do it properly either. So I find that those people that are kind of posing, as I think you put it, or posturing, tend to fall away quite quick, and you learn to spot the people that are talking nonsense. I generally find that a good indicator of that is if people get defensive about the results that they've got. If you question somebody about something and they, not in any kind of adversarial way, but more in a way of, you know, can you elaborate a little bit more on this result that you've got? They'll tend to get their back up a little bit if it is nonsense, you know, and they won't be able to substantiate that.
On the note of people lying about the results of that sort of that fashion trend, people saying that it like they were able to summon it in the bathroom, making it out to be easy. You were talking about like how strenuous this really is. What does a prepared magician look like? Because I feel like one of the things keeping a lot of these people in that armchair on Facebook, just hanging out in the graveyard, is just how specific these ceremonies are. Could you elaborate on that?
I absolutely can. Yeah, for sure. Well, as I say, it is strenuous and it is difficult. It first requires a lot of research on your part to know what you're doing and get the step-by-step correct. And as I say, there's a lot of conflicting information out there. So it does require a little bit of a scholarly approach to it and some dedication in that respect. But what a prepared magician looks like, again, I'm not trying to misrepresent myself as some kind of master magician or someone that is the authority on this, because I'm by no means any kind of authority on this. I'm just somebody that has been doing it for a number of years and has had some interesting results and is starting to see more of those. And I can just tell you how I do it. And if people disagree with that, they disagree with it. And if people want to try that, then great. So if you're going prescribed by the grimoires, there's a lot of preparation involved with approaching any kind of magic ritual. And when I say the grimoires, I'm largely referring to the Goetia here. As we said, that's the kind of the most popular, the one people are most familiar with. Things that the magician has to do is they have to purify themselves. Purity seems to be very important in communing with these entities, and I'm not 100% sure why that is, but it is. And I've noticed a difference when I've experimented with not doing those things to when I actually have them. And that involves long periods of fasting and staying away from certain things in your diet, staying away from intoxicants, daily prayers and confessions, abstinence from any kind of sexual activity. Also, there's the actual preparation and creation of the tools. You know, there are a lot of things that you need in magic that you can't go without in the ritual. At least I wouldn't go without them. Things like a magic circle, you know, the circle that you see in a lot of the grimoires that the magician is to stand inside when conjuring these entities. It takes a long time to create one. It takes a long time to draw one out. It takes a while to consecrate one. The same with your robe, same with your sword, the same with your phylactery layman's, your protection that you wear. These are all things that have very specific instructions on how they need to be created, and the materials are not easy to come by. You know, I had an operation recently that I performed in which the spirits layman had to be engraved on tin. And you'd be surprised how difficult a sheet of pure tin is to find. I managed to find a 6-inch by 8-inch square, which cost me close to $300 to get my hands on it. It was the last one in this area of the country that I'm in. You know, these things are difficult to come by. But you either do it properly or you don't do it, I think. That's kind of my attitude towards it. Because if you're going to put all of this effort in and you're going to go to the effort of finding somewhere that's appropriate to perform an evocation and to do all of that purity and to do all that purification, and to do all of these things that go along with it, all of that rework, burning all of these conjurations, and then you get to the point where you're actually performing the ritual and you realize that it doesn't work because you've left something out just out of laziness. It just seems so such a waste, you know. Seems so pointless if that's what you're going to do. So I've tended to just stick to the book. I've tended to just try and do it to the best of my ability, as prescribed in the text that I'm working from, and that's what I've seen results from. I have experimented with other types of more modern stuff just out of curiosity, because of course if there's a shortcut then I want to know it, because it's not particularly fun having to having to fast for days and having to say all of these prayers, narrations, and do these ritual baths and things like that prior to the operation. So if there was a way of getting around that, I did want to know about it. But unfortunately, it was back to the drawing board, because I found all of the more modern methods to be largely ineffective.
Well, those are all very good points. And I agree with you that when undertaking something of this magnitude, it would be remiss to not follow it by the book, at least in this particular case. You mentioned something about in the preparation for the ritual, talking about prayer and you said something and now I'm completely blanking on a confession. That's what I'm saying. And so one thing that I have grappled with when it comes to the ceremonial tradition is obviously the focus on the Judeo-Christian tradition. And so I'm curious to know, for people that are interested in this but have a difficult time with that aspect of it, how would you say to either get your mind around it or even get around it? And also, what would you say about the possibility of using this technique to summon and commune with beings that are not detailed in the Goetia from other traditions and pantheons, such as the pagan tradition or the Egyptian tradition? I know that Thelema is concerned with that specific aspect, but in your opinion, what would your advice be for people like me, who, you know, I consider myself to be a heathen of the northern tradition, and I've had a hard time with you know, the Christianization of this tradition, and I know that it did start from a Christian origin. But for people that want to not move away from that, but find an avenue to commune with the spirits in their tradition using this method, what would you say to that?
Well, this is unsurprisingly something that I come up against a lot. It's something that people ask my advice on an awful lot, because there is a kind of natural abhorrence, particularly in the West, towards the Christian orthodoxy, and that's not without reason. But I always ask them the same thing, and I'll ask you if that's all right, Joel. What is it that you're bumping up against that paradigm causes an issue for you? Like, what specifically is it about that paradigm that causes you some kind of hesitation or is acting as a roadblock?
Well, I think I've thought about this question a lot in my research, and I think the thing that I keep coming back to is if you look back through history, you begin to see when the monotheistic tradition separated itself from the Zoroastrian civilization, that the God that is talked about in the Bible It feels to me as though when the Judeo-Christians were fighting the polytheists and the pagans of antiquity, they needed a method of control and oppression to sort of get their way across. And if you look at it from that perspective, it becomes very easy to understand how that would go. I mean, if you're a landowner in Mesopotamia or even Europe, pre-Christian Europe, and you have serfs that work, that do your work for you, and you tell them that, that Odin, for example, wants them to work harder and that they're not working hard enough and they're not dedicating themselves to their serfdom, and that it is their place to do so. And one of these serfs says, well, I don't care what Odin says. I venerate Tyr or I venerate Thor. Well, the best way to fix that is to tell them, well, all of those gods are demons. Those gods are wrong. This is the true God. And if you look at the time frame that we're talking about, it appears that the God that is prescribed or described in the Bible is simply an amalgamation of aspects of the deities that were worshipped at the time, and that was done to make it more palatable for the remaining pagans and the polytheists of the day. And so when I look at that, I have a hard time, I guess, taking it seriously when I look at it from that perspective. I mean, what would be the purpose in me calling upon a figure that in actuality is just a hodgepodge of all these other deities instead of trying to find a tradition that specifically called upon the one the series of deities that this one god was sort of created out of, if that makes sense?
It does make sense. And there's quite a lot to unpack there. So maybe I can go through this bit by bit. So you're not wrong in what you say, in that the codification of the Christian Bible, it could be argued that that was a large part of what unified an empire that covered a number of places with a number of cultures under one umbrella. And a pretty smart political decision on the part of the emperor. All that is to say that yes, of course, there is a game of telephone there, and I don't think any magician, I mean, maybe some would, but I wouldn't say any of the magicians that I've spoken to would even suggest for a second that the Bible is a good place to find historical accuracy and that there aren't mistranslations, miscommunications, and just omissions from it that make up the entire picture. However, what I will say is, you asked the question, why would I call upon these names that are listed in the Grimoire, the holy names of God that essentially hark back to the Judeo-Christian God? And in short answer is because it works. That's why you use that system. Now, one of the other things that you mentioned was a propensity towards the pagan gods. Now, I think that it's important to remember that wherever there has been power, at any point throughout history, there have been people that have been using the apparatus of that time that cultural apparatus, in order to assert power over the people of that population, the serfs, as you put it. So I think it would be worthwhile remembering that even in pagan societies or polytheistic societies, religion has always been an apparatus of power. And priests, in combination with rulers, have always used people's beliefs to ensure that they are subservient and that the hierarchy stays in place. So I think that there is this danger of viewing pre-monotheistic religions through rose-tinted glasses. I think a lot of people look at the occult and they go, well, Christianity did so many terrible things, and you had the Inquisition, and they conquered all of these places, and it was all in the name of this Christian God. I want nothing to do with that. I think, to a large degree, that's throwing the baby out with the bathwater. I think if you can separate what Christianity is, nobody is asking a magician to go out and become an evangelical preacher and or a Baptist and go from door to door selling Bibles. You know, that's never the question. You don't have to be a devout Christian to be a magician. But to say that you would replace that paradigm with some of the pagan gods because they seem more affable towards you, I think is maybe a little bit of a misunderstanding as to what the pagan gods were actually like. And if you look at ancient history, let's take, for example, Zeus from the Greek pantheon. You know, one of Zeus's favorite pastimes was to disguise himself and go down to earth so that he could rape mortal women. You know, hardly a character that you want to have a beer with. You know, and you can find examples like that all the way through throughout history. The tradition that you mentioned, the Norse pagan tradition, Odin and Thor and Freya and Loki and however many other gods. You know, these were
all of those gods. As someone who has done a fair bit of research into the Norse tradition, thing that I think people get hung up on, at least reading the Eddas, is they're confronted with the fact that morality in that time was very, very different than it is now. And for example, the chief sin of the Viking Age was oath breaking or breaking a promise or lying. That was seen almost, in many cases, was seen as worse than murder. In most cases in the Norse lifetime, murder could be excused if it was an act of revenge, if it was in the name of honor. It kind of came down to what the motivation was for the ending of a life. And you're right that the gods of antiquity were not straight and narrow. They were not these clean, pretty gods. I mean, there is a part in the Younger Edda, the Poetic Edda, where Thor is coming back from Jotunheim from just killing many giants for no particular reason other than he wanted to. And Odin is disguised for whatever reason as a ferryman, and Thor comes to the lake and he says, you know, he's having a conversation with Odin that he believes to be a ferryman, and Odin is basically just mocking him. But there's a specific part where they're sort of talking about each other's achievements and where the other one was during that time. And so Odin talks about a time when he was having his way with a woman and pleasuring a woman, and he says, "Thor, why did you not come and help me rape this woman?" Essentially, and Thor says, "Well, if I had known about this, I would have absolutely come and held down that woman while you had her way with her." So there's many examples of how these gods have what I consider to be a very chaotic form of morality. They kind of did what they wanted to for their own justifications. And so while I don't believe that these gods are in any way more holy, and I mean that with a like W-H-O-L sense.
Yeah,
then,
I think, yeah.
Yeah, since then the Christian God, I feel that and this goes into one of my biggest arguments with monotheism is the sense of draconian duality, where if you don't do what is described in the Bible, then you're not just a lazy person, you're not just a bad person, you're up there with Belial and Lucifer and all the other baddies of the Bible. And if you do exactly as you're told and do not question it at all, then you will be granted a glorious afterlife. And to me, that is so anti-human, and it is anti-nature. There's no such thing as duality in nature. You know, when a lion eats a baby gazelle, that lion in no way is evil. He is simply just going after the easiest target he can to survive. And so that's been one of my gripes with Christianity, but more so my alignment with paganism, is that it seems to have a much more natural sense of morality and right and wrong, and it just seems more akin to human nature.
Well, maybe that's true to a degree, I suppose, but it is also more akin to the. And I don't want to come across as some kind of Christian apologist because I'm not a Christian. But you're asking me about the efficacy of using a particular paradigm in magic, which I think we're kind of meandering towards getting to some kind of conclusion on that. But you're absolutely right.
We won't spend too much time because I do want to get into the experiences you've had and the more nature of the deities that and the entities that are prescribed in the Goetias.
No, absolutely, and I think that's. But what you brought up here is valid, and I think that it is something that a lot of your listeners or people that are interested in the occult bump up against almost immediately because they open a grimoire and they see the first conjurations and prayers and you're summoning beings by the holy names of God who created the earth. And, you know, there are a lot of grimoires that are written in a Catholic context as well and even bring in things like the Holy Trinity and stuff. So I think that it is something that's definitely worth addressing. You're absolutely right in what you say. The gods of antiquity had a very warped sense of morality and a very warped sense of humor. Humans were largely their plaything to be used as they saw fit. If you gave them enough rewards and you bribed them enough, then maybe they would do you some favors and, you know, not strike your children down with smallpox or any other manner of horrendous things. And these were hard times, and the followers of these gods were hard people. The Vikings were very hard people and spent a lot of their time raping and pillaging their way through through Europe. And so, you know, you are right in that sense. I think that, like you say, people come up against more than the actual nature of the Hebrew God himself. It's more the orthodoxy and the control that Christianity has asserted over the world for such a long period of time, and people automatically kick against that. But I think it would be maybe misleading to think that you are asking a magician to be a Christian, because you're not. And you don't have to be a Christian. You are using a system that was written in a Christian context. And I think that the best way for people to approach any kind of magical practice is to practice it as it's written first before you start augmenting it for those reasons. You know, I think at some point you've got to ask yourself, how much does it actually bother me, you know, to call on these names, which are calling on a being that humanity has not even come close to being able to describe. And you're not by any way discounting the existence of other beings in the universe or there being room for them in your practice of this magic. But this particular system is concerned with summoning entities that are obedient to that name. I don't know, for whatever reason, why that is, but I know that when they are conjured, they are constrained and bound by those names. For some reason, they are obedient to that. Now, again, an explanation to that does somewhat escape me. I'm not 100% sure or convinced that summoning Thor or Odin using those same parameters would be as effective. I don't know that they would be obedient to those things. But what I do know is that in ceremonial magic, the actual conjuring of spirits, the conjuring of demons, these certain names are used because these are ones that have been shown to actually constrain them, that they are actually obedient to. And that's not to say that there isn't efficacy in other systems using different deities, because of course there is. But in magic, there has always been a tradition of calling down a hierarchy. The spiritual world is arranged into a very, very strict hierarchy, and calling down entities of varying power from the top to bottom is kind of the way that you end up getting to the spirit that you want to call. And that's evident in Egyptian magic as well, and a number of other ancient practices. So I do understand your concern there, and I think that a lot of people do end up heading towards what we might call the left-hand path, and I think we've discussed this previously before, that I've always found a little bit confusing because it kind of reinforces the duality that they're professing to oppose.
But I would agree with you 100% on that. I think Alden has something you want to ask.
On the note, the name swap, you believe that the name swap wouldn't be particularly effective. The ceremonies from these grimoires, like you've said, they're largely written through a Christian lens, and that's where a lot of people with hang up have, at the very least, have questions, if not just a disdain for. Is there any kind of link, do you believe, with a person's cultural or religious background? For instance, if we were to read on ceremonies that are built around the names of those other deities and the natures mm-hmm. of those deities, would he be any more or less effective using those to the letter versus if he followed one translated or rooted in the Christian pantheon to the letter as well? Is there any kind of reinforcement that would give, or does that have any effect at all on the efficacy?
Well, that's a really interesting idea, and it's one that's addressed in quite a famous book called Ceremonial Magic and the Power of Evocation, which is by Dr. Joseph Basiewski, which is I do recommend that anyone interested in magic picks up, because it's a breakdown of the mechanisms of ceremonial magic with an addition of the Heptameron at the back of the book. So it's a good place to start. It's the place I started, in fact, the first that I bought on ceremonial magic. So whilst it did scare the living hell out of me when I wrote it, and anyone that reads it will kind of understand why that is, but it's a good start. And one of the things that he talks about in there is what's known as the subjective synthesis of the magician. And what he means by subjective synthesis is that you practice magic within your own cultural context, because you are likely to find more efficacy in doing so. Now, it's difficult for me to say because I've never practiced magic outside of my own cultural context. I'm not a practicing Christian, but I was raised in a Western, loosely Christian environment. So I'm familiar with the idea of angels and demons, and these things populate my internal landscape quite easily. I don't know how much effect I would have if I were to practice Hindu magic, because I've never had interaction with these spirits. I don't know how I would approach them. I wouldn't know what to expect from their nature. I wouldn't know how to approach the Norse gods. So Lasiewski believes that there is some relevance to that. I can't say that I've worked much outside of the things that I'm familiar with as far as the spirits go. I've never tried to summon a Norse god. And, you know, to make it clear as well, I've never tried to use the Goetic procedure to make anything other than the spirits that are listed in the Goetia. But perhaps it could work. You know, I mean, Octavian, when you finally get to the point where you're ready to try, you know, let's experiment with that. I'd love to hear your results from that one. But I would suggest that it would have some effect, I think, even just psychologically on you as the magician, that you would be less prepared for what you were about to face, less prepared with how to deal with it, because you're entering into completely unknown territory. And that's not to say that you can ever really prepare yourself for the contact with a Goetic spirit or an angel, but you kind of know what you're getting yourself in for to some degree if you've come from a Christian background. There's some resonance, albeit slight, with the names that you're using to the powers that you're calling on. I wonder if that would be the same thing if you were to practice something that's completely outside of your realm of understanding, or completely outside of your realm of culture, at least.
Well, that's something that I'd like to explore. I think,
thank you.
Yeah, that was a great answer. I think that there is a certain ease in the fact that even though I was not, you know, I was raised what I consider to be Jewtheist, which is my family is Jewish. At least half of them are. I do have some Catholicism in the other side of my family, as well as a direct route to pagan ancestors. But I think because one of the things that I've always battled with other pagans are, you know, when it comes to like the Reconstructionists, who believe that the only way to get any kind of answer from the Norse gods is to use the methods that they believe their ancestors did back in the 700s. And my problem with that is that if these are truly real, omnipotent is not the right word, but if these are real gods and they do have the powers that are described to them and ascribed to them, it should stand to reason that they would hear your call to them regardless of the method, because they should be able to see through time and space and realize that, oh, okay, so this person isn't necessarily doing what my followers did 1,000 years ago, but he is attempting to make contact with me. So they should have, they should be able to receive that. There shouldn't be, logically speaking, a barrier based on time in what you, in the method in which you use to contact these entities. But that's just my own theory.
Respectfully disagree with that one, I think, actually, just from, and again, only going off the back of my own experience. And I'm not stating this as any kind of objective fact. This is just things that I've come to notice, is that, and it, you know, this came out, I think it was explained brilliantly when you had Julia on the show a little while back, and she was talking about astrology, and she said that she doesn't know why it works, but there are rules. And the rules work. We can figure out the how, we just can't figure out the why. And I do think that that's applicable to magic. And I think that if that were the case, then, you know, just staring at a demon sigil and saying what you want would be enough for that to come about. And through experimentation with some of the more modern, I hesitate to call them grimoires, but some of the more modern books on magic, I found that to be not the case. There are rules, there are ways of approaching spirits, there are ways of approaching gods that they expect. And John King described this as predefined terms between the humans and the spirits, that they, somewhere along the line, these rules, these protocols were set down, and this is what they respond to. And they respond to things that are familiar. They're used to being called in this way. And that is the most effective way to get in touch with. Now, can you get in touch with them in other ways? I don't know. I haven't really tried. The few attempts that I've made in experimenting with things outside of the norm, a funny way of phrasing it, the norm. But the few attempts that I have tried with that have been largely unsuccessful. So I'm inclined to tend towards the idea that these practices and these rules are not arbitrary, and that they're in place for a reason. And I don't know why these certain things, saying these things at this certain time, burning this particular type of incense, facing in this particular direction, causes a reaction from a spirit that compels it to come towards you. But it does, and I would hazard a guess that it's similar with deities from other traditions. And you can certainly see commonalities between the Western magical tradition and traditions in other cultures. So I'm thinking that there is some kind of objective truth to these things.
And that's a perfectly logical way of looking at it. And I appreciate that we can have a discussion where we both agree and disagree on different theories and practices. I think that's what makes this such a special kind of medium. Your experiences, can you talk a little bit about the experiences you've had, and then maybe go into sort of the nature of these spirits and what they are and what they aren't, and how to navigate these kind of spaces with the context of what these entities may be and what they respond to and what they don't respond to in your experience?
For sure, yeah. I think this is the juicy bit, right? It's what everybody kind of always asks about. I think if you indulge me a little preamble prior to going into that, would that be okay?
Preamble away.
Thank you. Thank you very much indeed. So I think the way that, as you can probably tell by the way I'm talking, I try and approach my practice, my ritual practice, my magical practice, in a fairly grounded and pragmatic way, which sounds like a strange thing to say, but not to people that practice it regularly, I don't think. I think a lot of people are coming to the conclusion that you need to approach this in an almost scientific and rigid way. And I think a large issue with what's going on in the occult community today, and I suppose there's nothing inherently wrong with it. People are getting what they desire out of magic. It all depends what you come to the traditions for. I find a lot of people are coming to it for, just a kind of weird and spooky experience. And certainly magic can provide you with that without much difficulty. But I think in doing so, you're leaving quite a lot on the table, because you're able to do some very, very miraculous things with it. And once you start seeing successes, that you do start to wonder where the possibilities end with it. But I think one of the most important tools that I've had as a magician or a practitioner for the years that I've been doing it is, I think, self-criticism. And I'll explain why I say that. I think that when I'm performing magic, then I am very, very results oriented. And there's a reason for that. The results that I get in the physical world, if they're not congruent with what I've asked of the spirit, I consider that operation a failure. Even if I've had some strange experiences during the ritual, if there have been things that I've been doing and I've performed the ritual to the letter, and I've even got some kind of apparition in the room, and I'm concrete sure that it is there, unless I have managed to get that spirit to do what I've asked it to do, I consider that to be a failure. Now, the reason for that is, and I'm not trying to be materialistic or simplistic about my approach to magic, because, of course, it's incredibly humbling and it's incredibly profound when you have these experiences. It completely reframes your view on reality and the world and what is and what isn't. And, that kind of fried my brains for quite some while I struggled with what these things were and how it was possible for them to show up, because I think everybody kind of goes in expecting it not to work. And then when it does, you're kind of woefully unprepared for it.
I think the only intellectually honest way to do it, to go into it, is to think it doesn't work and just be pleasantly surprised when it does.
Exactly. And I think that's almost the default position for everybody that comes from a veritably secular society, that you kind of going, well, this could be interesting, but I highly doubt it will work. And then when it does, it does force you to really rethink things in quite a big way. But the thing is, I think it's really important to be honest with yourself as a magician about what constitutes a result, what constitutes a successful ritual. I never want to be one of those people that's deluding themselves. And I think that, it's fairly obvious from scientific studies into things like schizophrenia and different meditative states that the human brain can get into, that the human mind is perfectly capable of inducing auditory and visual hallucinations and seeing things and hearing things that aren't actually there when you're in particular states of mind. Aleister Crowley called it being inflamed by prayer. And I think people can get themselves into these states of psychological ecstasy where things start firing off that don't usually fire off. And you can see and hear things that are seem very profound, but are frankly just in your head. So what the mind can't do, at least in my experience, is pluck something out of the backside of the universe congruent to what you've asked for 24, 48 hours ago from a spirit that was in the room with you, and drop it into your lap miraculously against all odds and chance. That, I think, is the bar by which I measure my practice from. If I've not got a result, then I did something wrong. Something there wasn't adding up. For some reason, it just didn't work. And I think if you approach it like that, then you can go back to the drawing board and you can troubleshoot. Okay, where was it in this? Because I've got this to work X amount of time. So why this time did it not work? And quite often when you look back, if you, and that's one piece of advice that I can give to anyone that's getting into magic is just take vigorous, precise notes as much as you can. Do a post-mortem on every operation that you do and sit and write out as much as you can about what you experienced, exactly what you asked for, exactly how the operation went, things that you noticed. And quite often, if you go back and you're a good note taker, you can usually find the points where you might have gone, ah, okay, well, maybe I didn't do this right. Maybe this went wrong here. Maybe I didn't execute this part properly. And you can generally fix those things and then achieve success. But let's say for the sake of argument, if you're performing a ritual to a demon-like Sitri from the Goetia, whose ability is to incite lust in a specific person. And I'm not advising that people do this, but I'm saying that if that were your goal as a magician, and you were to conjure that spirit, and you believed that it was there and it happened, and you direct them towards a specific person, this is the girl or the boy that I have a crush on, and I want them to be inflamed with lust for me. And then a waitress smiles at you the next day. I don't think you can consider that a result. If somebody flirts with you the next day, but that person that you directed your ritual towards still shows you no interest, that's a failure. And I think kidding yourself is not helpful in progressing in magic. You have to be fairly prepared for failure to some degree before things start getting a little more successful. Because the self-delusion is just not a currency for success when it comes to magic.
This is a point that I get into a lot with other pagans, especially practicing pagans, who, when they, let's say, do a ceremony, or they give an offering to their chosen deity on their altar, and then, you know, they ask it a favor or ask it to show its presence, and then a bird, a specific kind of bird, comes to the window, or the flame on their candle that they have lit flickers in a peculiar way, but that's it. And they say, I can't believe it. Freya is here with me now. I've done it correctly. I have the favor of this incredible deity that I worship, and I to me that is delusional, and I really can't stand the when I see people kind of grasping at straws in order to gain some sort of insight or an answer. And I think that's what's brought me into the idea of ceremonial magic within the Norse tradition, is if there is a possibility of me being able to use a specific method to call upon a deity, in my case, the Norse pantheon, and have it appear in my space in somewhat physical form that is undeniable. That is something I am very, very attracted to.
Yeah, and I think that is what most people are attracted to when they get into magic. And you know, I'm not trying to be a cheerleader for the type of magic that I personally practice. You know, everybody has to get to a point that they're comfortable with on their own. And you know, I'm just saying that this is what I use. This is what I get results with. This is what I've had some fairly miraculous experiences as a result of things that I couldn't have done, I don't think, without doing this. But yes, you're absolutely right. And I think that there is sometimes, you know, if you've tried and you've tried and you've tried, you're kind of desperate, then it's natural to kind of look for things to reaffirm, you know, that you're not wasting your time.
Just to let you know, the incense that we have burning right now is, the smoke is going in an interesting pattern. So Belial is absolutely with us right now. So Luke, go ahead and say hi to Belial.
Well, clearly he did mention that he was going to pop by at some point, yeah. So I'm glad he made it. Glad he found the address.
He's a demon of miraculous timing, if nothing else.
Well, clearly, yes, indeed. Well, it's understandable why people get to that point. But I think that it is important that to have something tangible to be able to measure your success by. Because really and truly, you know, if we're all being completely honest with ourselves, if you really want something to happen, you can convince yourself that there is something in the room for you. And I don't ever want to be one of those people that's stood in a candlelit room just talking to himself. You know, that is a waste of time for anybody involved, I think. So the tangibility of your results and how closely they measure up to exactly what you've asked for, and then, you know, the ratio of what the chances of that happening on its own were, I think is that you can start to get to that point then where you actually have a bar by which to measure by. And I do think that that's important. Now, you know, that's not to disregard other people's personal gnosis or experiences, because who am I to do that? That's just simply the way that I go about looking at my own practice, because I don't want to be wasting my time. And I've found that largely, you know, visualization and mind work and, you know, hoping that something would happen just doesn't work, you know, and enforcing your true will on the universe just doesn't work. So, you know, I have these things that I do, and I see results. And of course, you know, everybody's free to explore their own path and get to wherever they need to get on their own. But there are a number of things that I see that are kind of making excuses for results not happening. One of the most egregious offenders of that is, have you ever heard of the expression, the lust for results? Yeah. Not a magical concept, really. I mean, there are a couple of grimoires that say that those that don't believe won't get, but generally it's not, I haven't known it to be a massively important principle in magic. And I think when those things are making a reference, they're actually making a reference written from the Christian paradigm. If you don't have faith and venerate God, then he's not going to do you the favor of giving you the ability to be able to speak to these spirits. But let's not get back into the Christian question. But yeah, the lust for results, you see that a lot. And it's kind of this bleed over from the New Age, you know, manifestation gurus and law of attraction folks that has kind of found its way into magic. And I've always found that to be such a strange concept, because it seems to suggest that, you know, if you want something, the best way to get it is to stop wanting it. But, well, I mean, if you're performing magic, of course you're lusting for the result. You know, if you fasted for 2 weeks, abstaining from having sex with your spouse, not been eating meat, you know, been doing these daily prayers and adorations and waking up at ungodly hours, drawing circles on the floor and all other manner of things that magicians get up to. It's because you want something. Why would you go to all of that effort if you didn't want it? And I've personally never noticed that the lust for results, as they put it, being particularly significant in ritual practice at all. In fact, some of my most successful rituals were the ones that I didn't believe were actually going to work. So I find that to be maybe thrown around a little bit too much as an excuse for something not working, and as opposed to actually taking a rather hard look at the practice that you've done and gone, well, okay, you know, that 2 weeks of preparation and that 3 hours of ritual that I did, that was a waste of time because I didn't get what I wanted. So, you know, back to the drawing board, let's go again. It takes a certain amount of tenacity and perseverance, and that's tough, you know, that's really tough to do, and it can be quite demoralizing at some time. But that's something that's managed to find its way into the occult community. It was like, oh, you know, don't lust for results, because then it won't happen. It's just, to be honest, it's not something that I've ever found to be true.
I can speak to that from personal experience, just because when I started my path, many of the texts that I was reading and the books on specific paths start off by a rigorous meditation routine, and it is somewhat of a blocking mechanism, from what I've come to understand, where, you know, if you aren't meditating every day for 3 months, then you shouldn't even think of going further with this work, because you haven't mastered your mind, therefore you will never be able to master any kind of entity that you hope to bring about into the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that was part one of our conversation with Luke, the ceremonial magician. Part two will be next week. All of his information will be in the show notes below. Our Patreon is up, and there are four tiers of support, as I said in the beginning. And if you would like to show support for the show, that would be the best way and most beneficial way for you to do so. So I'm Octavian Graves.
And I'm Alden.
And we hope you have a great night, and we will see you next week.